have three bills. We'll have two work sessions. We'll have a public hearing and work session, and then we will have an information hearing on a very important insurance, reinsurance, malpractice physician bill. So we will start with Senate Bill 60. I will open a work session on Senate Bill 60. Yeah, you want to talk about
it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 60 authorizes the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service and the Housing and Community Services Department to establish and implement programs that encourage and reward civic participation and volunteerism.
Okay, any questions on Senate Bill 60? We did have the public hearing last time. I thought it was a very good public hearing. There is not a fiscal impact. That question was asked. It's a great bill, gets people involved. So unless there are questions, yes.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 60 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 60 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, would you call the roll, please?
Okay, Senator
Mona
Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz? Aye.
Chair Morsak?
Aye.
Okay, Senate Bill 60 passes. We'll go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who would like to carry the bill?
Do you have any volunteers?
A volunteer. Are you volunteering?
Yes,
sure. Okay. Very good. And the next bill is Senate Bill 61. I will open a work session on Senate Bill 61. You want to explain the bill, please?
Senate Bill 61 directs the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service to identify and adopt best practices related to screening and supervising volunteers and conducting criminal record checks on volunteers.
Okay. Any questions about, yes.
Move Senate Bill 61 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 61 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Questions, comments? Okay. The question came up of the background check and how extensive that would be and expensive also, and under what circumstances the bill does deal with best practices for organizations, and it does take into account that some of the volunteers might be working with vulnerable populations, children, elderly, and so on, and so background check certainly might be appropriate at times. Again, there is no fiscal impact. I think it's a great bill. It does encourage volunteerism and gives guidance to organizations that are seeking volunteers.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd just like to point out, it mandates nothing of local organizations. It just gives them a resource
right
to go to if they want to conduct checks. So I think that's very positive.
Yeah. Okay, hearing no other no objections, we will, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator
Mona
Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair
Mona? Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 61 passes unanimously with a due pass recommendation, and Senator George will carry that bill as well.
I will volunteer again.
Okay, you'll volunteer again. Thank you. You volunteer once, and you're on the list. Okay, we're going to have a public hearing. I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 82. You want to go ahead and read the
Senate Bill 82
background?
Requires a valid unexpired prescription before ophthalmologic contact lenses can be dispensed or sold.
Okay, very good. David Plunkett, would you come up, please? Wesley Warpole. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank Okay, who would like to start?
I'll start.
Okay, go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
My name is David Pluckin. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Optometry. And I have with me today Dr. Wesley Vorpahl, who is an optometric physician from here in Salem.
Welcome.
Thank you. I think Senate Bill 82 is a pretty straightforward bill. What it would do would make the dispensing and selling of ophthalmic contact lens without a valid prescription a prohibited act under 683-180, and it would add a new section 9, number 9, to the bill. What this would do then would allow the Oregon Board of Optometry the ability to enforce the provision along with the other optometry statutes. So as part of my handout, I included, you might say, what is an ophthalmic contact lens? Well, the definition, as stated in the bill, it's a contact lens with refractive power, with or without refractive power, including a plano or a decorative contact lens. And I gave you some samples that I'd pulled off the internet on the back sheet of what maybe a decorative contact lens might look like if you haven't seen them. They happen to have all kinds of designs in them, and they're purely kind of, as we relate, they are decorative in manner. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, considers an ophthalmic contact lens a medical device. This means that a written prescription by an optometric physician or an ophthalmologist is required for the lens to be dispensed or sold. What we have going on now in Oregon and across the country is that these plano and cosmetic lenses are being distributed and sold without prescriptions, without proper fittings by qualified eye care professionals. And they're being sold in places like we have seen on beauty markets, beauty salons, clothing stores, places of that nature, record stores and record and video stores. So there's all kinds of establishments selling these lenses. And as I pointed out, these contact lenses, just like any, and Dr. Vorpahl can speak to this better than I, but like any contact lens that's on your eye, have the danger, and some of the dangers, they have dangers of eye injury and even blindness in the worst, like the worst case scenario. They are, some of the things the FDA has identified as far as complications, but could be as simple as an allergic reaction, impaired vision, conjunctivitis or other eye infection. It could lead to corneal scarring. And then even in the worst case scenarios, things such as blindness or even loss of the eye. And for obvious reasons, the Oregon Board of Optometry requests an eye vote on this bill. I might add that this is something that other states have already done. I know of at least 9 other states that have included specific language in the last 2 or 3 years to deal with this situation, and some of the states may already have had provisions that allowed that, but I know that there have been at least 9 since this. This is a, I think, fairly new thing on the scene of decorative lenses and plano lenses, colored lenses, and with no powers, and I think some established mistakenly think that because there's not a power included in the contact in the lens, that it's not dangerous. But of course, that's not so at all. We have tried over the last 2 or 3 years to voluntarily to get some establishments to quit selling them. We haven't really had the enforcement power, but we've written them letters, we've told them that it is a violation of the FDA, there is a law that prevents this, please stop selling them, and that hasn't really worked. So that's the reason we're before you today.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Senator George.
Is there any regulation of the manufacturer of these things? Because in addition to where they're being sold, I'm thinking, how do you know what's in that plastic when you would slap it on your eye?
Senator Morissette, Senator George, very good question. Yes, they are regulated by the FDA, which means that they do regulate, supposed to regulate the content and the validity of that lens. And there's been, what they found is that there was a lot of dumping of these lenses into this country. And so they're really suspect lenses out there. And I think the FDA probably has focused their attention on that issue and not with more on the illegal dumping kind of thing than they have on this.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Oh, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. Would you sell me lenses like this? I mean, obviously there are probably some, if I wanted to do a decorative thing, which I don't, but I mean, there would still be avenues to get them as a safe product. Would that be true?
Absolutely.
Okay. And thank you, Ms. Chair. And the other question is, this bill really doesn't have any impact on Internet sales, does it? Or does it? Because you can purchase on the Internet, so...
It'd be difficult. I'm not sure, Dave, if you...
Sir, Chris, I would think that if it was an Internet sale in Oregon, we probably could. Anything outside of Oregon, no. Okay. And that is definitely an issue, Internet.
That would be an interesting... Attorney General question, could you bring a complaint to the Attorney General about that? Would they follow through with it? That's a good point. Yes, Senator Von Sanderson.
Well, I think I'll wait till after the next.
Okay, go ahead and do your presentation. Did you have some?
No, I didn't have.
Okay. Mr. Chair. You know, I know a lot of teenagers that change the color of their eyes with whatever color outfit they're wearing. This is a very popular thing. And what I would like to know is, are there statistics out there on how many infections have resulted? How many? I know it says the FDA has identified the following potential risks, but I'm wondering, what is this really a problem? Before I would vote for it, I would actually like to have the data that shows that this truly is causing eye infections and allergic reactions and impaired vision.
Your question is a good question. And I don't have statistics, and I don't believe that you do either. Is that correct, Dave?
No.
Okay. I'm sure that I can obtain those for you, Senator. But I can tell you, just in my office where I do fit contact lenses, I do see when people come in with poorly fit lenses, not utilizing appropriate hygiene with their lenses, even when they've been instructed before, that have serious problems, corneal ulcers, keratitis, allergic reactions, that type of thing. So even when people have been shown how to take care of their lenses and supposedly have been fit appropriately, things still happen. When you bring up the situation where someone has had no appropriate education with their contact lenses on how to care for them, when to wear them, when not to wear them, you really enhance the chance of problems.
Mm-hmm. Follow on?
Yes.
You know, I look with disfavor on, you know, putting things in your eyes, but I also look with disfavor on tattoos that can cause terrible skin reactions with some people. Ear piercings is the same thing. There can be terrible infections with ear piercings. There are certain cosmetics that have toxic chemicals in them. And so that's why I'm hesitant to go be in favor of something like this until I really know that there clearly is a problem, because we do a lot of things to our bodies that aren't very nice. whether it's alcohol or methamphetamines, and of course
Senator
the outlet goes.
Senator Morris Anderson. The only response the board has not kept statistics on it, but I would imagine the FDA has some. But you realize, of course, we're not changing the laws whether or not a prescription is required. They have already determined that. All this would allow us to do is to do some enforcement of establishments that were selling them illegally without that proper eye care professional, without a prescription or without a proper fit by an eye care professional. So they've already made that determination that they're dangerous, and that's and as such, that a prescription is required. So really all this bill does is allow us to enforce it here in Oregon.
Okay. Senator George.
Two questions. Does FDA require that if you sell these things at flea markets and beauty salons and video, that there are instructions on how to prepare the eye and how to put it in and all the other, make sure it's clean? Are those instructions included when you buy a little set of these things?
Not to my knowledge.
So you're just going to get a little bag with lenses in it? Almost question.
Yes, go ahead.
Let's go ahead and I'll come back to that question.
Okay, Senator Verger.
Yes, I guess my question is, when you notified some of these places that they should desist from selling, I wonder why they weren't worried about the liability. In other words, if they really are just selling something that people can put in their eye that might cause some serious damage, they would also be very liable.
Senator Verger, Senator Morsetti. I can address that. I think many people don't look upon contact lenses, particularly soft lenses. When you put them in your eye, they're relatively comfortable, and millions of people wear them without significant problems. And so I don't believe that they might view the contact lenses as something that could cause a problem.
I see.
Would there be a difference? Okay. Let me back up just a bit to what something you said. You said that it's already illegal to sell contacts without a prescription.
Yes, that's true.
Okay. So that on that basis, you're saying that they're doing something that is illegal in the state of Oregon.
Yes, that's true. That's the FDA ruling that contact lenses are considered medical in nature. It's a medical appliance, and therefore contact prescription is required. They did that many years ago.
Okay. Now, what if we choose not to, or this bill doesn't pass? What would prevent someone from actually selling a contact with a prescription, just as you can buy glasses at your local fast food market with a prescription? You can buy those glasses. That's not illegal, right? So they could. There would be nothing to prevent people from advertising contacts with prescriptions.
That is true. Okay. As long as they get a valid prescription for the contact.
No. Would there be anything wrong if, under the existing lack of authority to require someone? Okay, as far as you're concerned, they're doing something illegal right now, right?
True.
Okay, that's what you're saying. They're doing something illegal. So if they added a prescription to a contact, it would still be doing something illegal. But would that make it more illegal than just a contact without? Okay, I'm impressed with your argument that it is currently illegal. Now, this bill specifies in detail which segment of the market you're going after. You're going after those. Well, let's see what it says here.
All of them, actually.
Okay, you're actually reinforcing something that's already in the law, right?
That is true, and our board is currently able to enforce it for the optometry profession, okay, we're not allowed to enforce it beyond that. And the AG's office has said we have no authority to go after people who aren't licensed. So if they aren't licensed with us, we can't go after someone in a flea market selling these.
Okay.
Even if they were selling them with a prescription.
Okay, so
that would be legal.
Okay. It gets even more complicated. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I look at some of these lenses, you know, the smiley face, you know, it kind of looks like my face, big round, you know, with a smile. But I've been told for years that your eyes quickly adjust and you actually start to change kind of the character. In other words, if you wear glasses for a long time, pretty soon your eye adjusts to that. Is there any danger here of a person affecting their eyesight by just the fact that you're affecting how the brain is reacting to what's blocking the image? I mean, has anybody looked at that? Because I'm sitting there thinking, I don't think that could be healthy to have that kind of obstruction, because the mind is going to try to analyze and how to compensate for that. Am I way out left field here or right field?
I don't know that I've seen, Senator George, Senator Marcetti. I don't know that I've seen a study related to that or know of that. I can see with some of these cosmetic lenses, however, that the potential is there to decrease vision by having the opacities that are necessary in the lens to form the pattern that's there. You know, I know that many people do not tolerate that, even with the types of cosmetic lenses that I will use in my office.
Sure.
So that's something that needs to be watched.
Can I do a follow-up on that?
Go ahead.
Because I've had to wear eye protection almost all my life, you know, a certain kind of obstruction, pretty soon you have a big headache. But the other thing here is, what about when this person gets into an automobile or gets on a bicycle or motorcycle and starts to drive? Have you guys ever looked through those to see what kind of obstruction that person has? Is how are they actually seeing the things around them? If they have this the star in the middle of it, the rock star, or the green reptile?
Why is a green reptile? Senator George, Senator Morsetti. I know that for a fact that they can interfere with vision, that they can decrease the perhaps contrast sensitivity, as well as the visual acuity.
Can I do a follow-up?
Yes.
Does Oregon State Highway Law prohibit us from wearing those things? Maybe another addition to the bill.
No, not that I'm aware of. And Senator George, this is one of the potential risks that the FDA identified was impaired vision. So, yes, I think you're absolutely right.
I'm getting a headache again. Can we move this bill today?
Well, I don't have a problem.
I'm just kidding.
Okay, we're going to stand at ease for just a moment. Okay, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session. On a work session on Senate Bill 82, do we have a...
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 82 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 82 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a no until I make a couple of phone calls. I truly need, I was hoping that you would have brought to the committee at least an indication of the stats for infections, the number of infections, you know, what problems there were, and whether the other states actually, what their legislation said in the other states. And I will have my staff do a little bit of homework, so I may be a yes on the floor, but I will be a no now.
Other comments?
Yeah, I'll just shortly. I mean, Mr. Chair, the lenses with refractive power make perfect sense to me because prescriptions wear out and or get old. And I've talked to my optometrist about that, and I complained that he should get me glasses that last forever, and they don't seem to. But and I wondered about these these very strange things here, and I'm thinking, what price vanity? And Senator George brought up a good point, as you know, you know, people driving with these things or even trying to function in some situations, and I don't think they should necessarily be available for a spur of the moment thing. I mean, you know, if somebody wants a different color change or wants to do something, there should be a little thought process in it, not just going by a flea market and picking something up and sticking them in their eyes and running into their telephone pole. So,
well, yes.
I worry a lot about scope of practice, too, in that people go to school and are trained to do certain functions, and they work hard and get their certifications, and then people come along and are able to get into the business, so to speak, without that kind of training, and I worry a lot about that, and so I have some questions about this, if you wanted to just really dig down into the detail of it, but the bill is very simple. All it does is require prescription. So I will be able to be a yes.
Well, I, too, am supportive. I think the difference between this and some of the other mutilations of the body are they're not illegal to start with. This, I think there are some requirements that people need to follow to be able to sell those. And but getting to Senator George's question about the eye adapting, I wore one contact one time for a long time. I didn't need two, I just needed one. And I couldn't figure out how my nearsighted and farsighted would work out, and it did. So my feeling is if you put something like that on your contact, you would probably not even notice it. I don't know. The mind would adapt, I think. But anyway, I think it's clearly, I think it's an important issue to bring before us, and that it is already illegal to sell them, and I see this as an extension, a specific extension of the existing law. So I too favor. So further discussion, seeing none, will you call the roll, please?
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Mon and Anderson?
No.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz? Aye.
Chair
Morrison? Aye. So Senate Bill 82 passes with a due pass recommendation. Do we have a due pass recommendation?
Yeah.
Okay.
We've got a carrier down there.
I thought you were going to carry this.
No,
Senator George's day.
I'm going to show up wearing these.
Oh, good, good. A dragon. The world looks like a dragon. Good. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item on the agenda is Senate Bill 183. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 183. Senate Bill 183 is... let me see the agenda for just a minute. Chris Davies, would you come up? Lottie Streisinger? Or Lottie? Oh, that's your mother. Okay. Scott, are you going to join us? Or? Yeah. Okay. This is a bill that I had contemplated introducing because I think obviously there is a problem with deciding the best use of state monies, even though they are safe monies, reserve monies, they are state monies, to use to encourage people to come and practice by helping with malpractice insurance, and I think it's a very worthy program, and I think it's successful. In fact, we've attracted a physician from Tennessee to come to Oregon to practice because of that. The concern, I think, of a lot of people is whether or not there is a mechanism to make sure that the money is being used wisely and efficiently, and if there is a prioritization of who should receive the funding and where the practice could be, because it is rural, but maybe there's an area of high need that we need to incentivize and so on. There are just a lot of issues. So the bill is in this committee, and I thought it would be appropriate to have just kind of an overview, a definition of the problem, and just to see where you're headed and how you're going to get there. So who would like to lead off?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Happy to be here today, and I will lead off on the bill, and then I think other people are prepared to go into considerably more detail. This bill, as you probably know, was enacted in 2003 with a four-year sunset. So the program is scheduled actually to end at the end of 2007 unless extended or revised in some fashion by this legislative session. The intent of the program was to assist rural physicians with their costs of professional liability insurance or medical malpractice insurance. And at the time, I think many of us were aware and concerned of the impact of professional liability insurance costs, and particularly in the impact in rural areas where there is a great need to attract and retain physicians, and we were seeing a number of physicians in rural areas considering leaving practice for a variety of reasons, but the cost of professional liability insurance was certainly identified as one. And a major area of interest, certainly for the governor and for a number of members of the legislature, was obstetric practice in particular, not only obstetricians themselves, but also family practitioners whose practice included obstetrics, for the very basic reasons that it's very difficult to attract families to rural areas and to persuade families to remain in rural areas if there are no obstetric services available when they wish to start a family. And we heard stories about people having to drive 45 minutes over the mountains in order simply to have access to obstetric care. So that was a major driver of this bill. And the bill, as it came out, instructed SAFE to establish a reinsurance program for medical professional liability insurance for rural physicians to cover a portion of their costs. And as it came out, all rural physicians, and I'll get to the definition issue in a minute, but all rural physicians were covered at some level, but with a higher level of subsidy for obstetricians. So up to 80%, subject to available funds, but up to 80% of professional liability insurance premiums for obstetricians are covered, up to 60% for family practitioners whose practice includes obstetrics, and up to 40% for all other rural physicians, subject to those definitions, and also subject to some caps on the amount of insurance. So physicians who chose to buy very large amounts of insurance would cover their own additional costs, but for the basic levels, I believe up to $3 million, that's where the bill kicks in. So SAFE then is reimbursed for the cost of the program through a credit against its workers' compensation premium assessments that it pays to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So the cost of the program for that four-year period was capped at an average of $10 million a year, or, in other words, a total of $40 million for the entire four-year period. But, in fact, the costs have been considerably lower than that, and for the initial four-year period, our current projections are a total cost of between $21 and $22 million, roughly speaking. The program has been successful in that it has assisted well over 1,000 rural physicians with their insurance costs. As of 2006, there are, I believe, and Chris will correct me if I'm wrong, 1,154 physicians in the program. And I believe Chris and Mr. Davey in his testimony will go through some detail about which counties and which specialties. But some questions have arisen, as I'm sure you're all aware, and as the chair mentioned, about the scope of the program and whether it is in fact sufficiently tailored to be fine-tuned in meeting the needs that were identified. And among the questions that have been raised are, first of all, what should be considered rural? And there are actually, I believe, and Mr. Ekblad is here and can go into more detail about that, five different definitions of rural in use in Oregon for various types of health services programs. And the decision was made in 2003 to use the broadest of those definitions. And so it includes anyone who is within 10 miles or further from 10 miles of a population center of 30,000, correct me if I get this wrong here, 30,000 or more. And so that is a lot of Oregon is included in that definition. Although, interestingly, there are a couple of communities that are just actually changing their status this year. Grants Pass, I believe, because of the population growth that it has experienced, is no longer qualifying as rural, for example. So there are some changes that are happening by the simple course of population growth. But that definition is very broad. So that's certainly one issue is, are we defining rural correctly?
Yes. Yeah, could I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hate to stop you, Corey, but I need to be sure. You said, in other words, unless you're within 10 miles of a city, you're rural. Who made that determination? Who picked that that definition?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, and I believe Senator Cruz is putting up his hand. The various definitions were adopted at various times for various different rural programs, but all of them are specific programs authorized for various provisions of law. And in 2003, in this bill, the legislative committees hearing the bill agreed with the selection of that specific definition. Okay. We presented the maps showing how the different definitions would apply.
Are you telling me that Senator Cruz was on that legislative committee that picked that definition?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I will let Senator Cruz speak for himself in that regard.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, yes, and we chose that because it was the broadest definition, and we were trying to, and there was a lot of discussion over what definition to use, and that was the one we chose because we thought it would help the most people.
A country boy did this.
Yes.
With help.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, if I recall correctly, it is very roughly one-sixth of the physicians in Oregon, just to give you some scope. So although in geographic area it covers great portions of Oregon, of course, as we all know, that doesn't mean it covers great portions of the population. So anyway, that issue of the definition of rural is clearly a public policy issue that's open for discussion. A second question that also was discussed in 2003 is, should all rural doctors qualify regardless of medical specialty? And if I recall during the hearing, somebody said, well, what about a dermatologist? And the answer was, the decision at least that was made at the time was, yes, actually, regardless of specialty, a dermatologist, a plastic surgeon, all doctors qualify, but at varying levels of subsidy, so that those who don't include obstetrics in their practice were at the 40% level. Again, a very legitimate public policy debate as to who you want to include and who you don't. And I will say there was some discussion about the difficulty of making distinctions based on specialty or practice area because, for example, for emergency services, reconstructive surgery or dermatology or plastic surgery might be a critical need for certain types of so it's very difficult to and I think the committee decided not to make qualitative distinctions based on practice area. The third significant issue that got discussion in 2003 was, should there be an income test? And the decision at that point was no, because for two reasons, actually. One of them that is that a number of the other types of subsidy programs which exist, whether tax credits or tuition assistance or other types of assistance, they do not primarily have income tests built in. And in addition, we got a lot of feedback that it would be extremely difficult to logistically manage an income test because of the wide varieties of financial arrangements that physicians have. Now, again, very legitimate public policy issue, but the decision in 2003 was not to make this subject to an income test. There are some distinctions about percentage of practice that has to be rural. So for somebody who practices part-time in a rural area, part-time in an urban area, so the bill does include that. And in addition, the program was limited to physicians who actually purchase a professional liability insurance. So it does not include, for example, a physician who is employed by a medical facility, a clinic or a hospital that provides coverage for its doctors. So it doesn't include policies that are purchased by the facilities as opposed to by physicians. And there was also a decision made not to include in the bill medical professionals who are not physicians. So the other types of medical professionals are not included. So a number of choices made, and all of which, because of the sunset, are of course on the table. The way that Senate Bill 183 is drafted, it continues the program for an additional four-year period, but within the originally authorized funding, does not increase the total funding. So that would mean it would be the remainder of the originally contemplated $4 million, and because we have another 4 years, that would mean some phasing out of the program over that four-year period, unless the scope is narrowed at this point so as to make the math spread that money over that four-year period. In what we did not, in the draft of the bill that you have in front of you, we did not change the income issue or the specialties or the percentages. What we did do in terms of the definition of rural is, in the bill, rather than picking a specific definition of rural, the bill would leave that to the judgment of the Office of Rural Health at OHSU. Now, that was simply for purposes of putting the bill in to promote the discussion. We do understand that there's a lot of interest in different ways to approach that issue, and we expect that there will be discussions, and we look forward to working with all of you on what the right policy decisions are on who should be eligible and how this program should work. And I should say that we are also very interested in the bigger picture discussion of what is needed to recruit and retain physicians to rural Oregon, because, of course, this is only one piece of what influences people's decisions. There are a wide variety of other issues. There are a wide variety of other programs, and I think we share the belief that a number of you have that we'd like to look at that in a more comprehensive way and say, is this, in fact, the right next step to be taking? So we look forward to having those discussions with you. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I believe the other folks up here are happy to provide more detail.
What about underserved areas that are not rural? Has that discussion come up? Inner city hospital theoretically might be having a hard time attracting a physician. Okay, that doesn't work for the hospital. That's private practice. Have you looked at that possibility?
Mr. Chair, not in connection with this bill, except very briefly. The reason being that once we go into urban areas, the numbers become very large very fast, and with a limited amount of funds, it's a challenge to decide how to spread it.
I guess what I'm thinking there is that the purpose of the bill is to get medical assistance where you need it. Rural Oregon is the top priority, but you know, it might be just as important at some point to bring a physician into an area that you can't get someone. That may not be the case in Oregon at the present time, though. I see it could be. So, okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes. Cruz?
Assuming status quo, assuming we don't change definition of rural and or the criteria for eligibility, when would this fund run out of money?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, it actually would make it most of the way, or should make it most of the way through the four-year period at roughly the levels in the bill, if we don't see a big spike in insurance rates. Interestingly, rates have come down this past year. We had about one of our major carriers announced about an 8% drop in rates. So the answer really is it depends on what happens to rates. The first 4 years, we are looking at approximately $21 to $22 million of that amount being spent. So just over half for the first four-year period. If rates stay flat, then it would last almost all the way through the next 4-period, next 4-year period. If we see rate increases come in again, then it would scale down. And the way the bill is structured, it requires SAFE to put together a plan. And so that would be something we would work out in the plan. And my anticipation would be that we would see the subsidy levels reduced in, say, years 2, 3, and 4 of the 4-year period, but hopefully not by a very substantial amount.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if another alternative might be an e-board reservation if we're getting close to the end. Of course, that's way out in the future. It would be also the possibility that we could revisit this in the 2009 legislative session, and if it's working and if more resources are needed, it would be easy to pop it in there. I think this has been successful. At limited scope, it's been successful. We did, Mr. Chair, we hassled over creating our own definition of rural, among a lot of other things, and I thought we were fairly well satisfied with where we ended up with, both in definition and in coverage. So I guess I would be concerned if we're going to move forward with reduction plans at this point in time, knowing full well that we have 2 biennia in which this will be operating, and we would have ample opportunity in 2009 to make adjustments if necessary.
Other testimony? Yes,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Chris Davey with SAFE Corporation, and with me is Peter Merck, who is a senior research analyst at SAFE, and Peter is the guy who actually administers this program on a day-to-day basis. Ms. Streisinger has given you a very thorough review of the program, and my written testimony covers a lot of the same points that she has already spoken about, so let me pick and choose a little bit from the written testimony that I had prepared. As you heard, the program began in January of 2004 and will sunset as it stands at the end of December in 2007. And although the statute is written in a fairly general sense about the form of the program, the specifics of the program are actually discussed between SAFE and DCBS and the Office of Rural Health and the Governor's Office and OMA and everybody else who had an interest in this during the time that the bill was passing through the legislature. And we then put together a written plan that was approved by DCBS before it took effect in January of 2004. Now, SAFE, in addition to administering the plan, also had a couple of other specific responsibilities that we had to discharge during the year of 2004. One of those was to coordinate the activities of a panel that was called the Professional Panel for Analysis of Medical Professional Liability Insurance. And that consisted of 2 members of the legislature. Representative Dolto and Senator Przanski sat on that panel. It was chaired by retired Judge Jacob Tamza. There were 3 or 4 other people on there, and they were looking at the medical malpractice issue and what were the factors that contributed to the cost of medical malpractice. One of the other things that we had to do in connection with that was to contract for an actuarial study that was then provided to that committee to take a look at. $200,000 was budgeted out of the original $40 million for the program to pay for that study. It was performed by a company called Pinnacle Actuarial, and that was reported back to that professional panel by the end of 2004. I think you've already heard who gets this and how much money they get. It's a $40 million program. You have to be an MD or a DO. Those are the only medical specialties that are covered by this program. You have to be in an area that is considered rural according to the existing standards of the Office of Rural Health. And you'll probably hear from Scott that those standards are already existed and serve some other purposes to do with tax credits and things like that. And so we were really piggybacking on an existing definition of what is a rural practitioner. I believe also that if your practice is located in an area that is not considered rural, but you spend roughly 60% of your time going out and serving in a rural area, you too can qualify for this program. You have to have medical insurance, medical professional liability insurance, malpractice insurance. It has to be with an insurance carrier that is authorized by the state of Oregon, and therefore subject to regulation by our insurance division. And it does not include employees of health plans or people who are salaried employees of medical organizations, where they are actually the ones that are purchasing the malpractice insurance. There are potentially 8 authorized carriers that could participate in that program, and 7 have chosen to do so, and they're listed on the bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3 of my testimony. How much money do they get? As you've heard, 80% if you're an obstetrician. That's 80% of the premium that you would pay for malpractice insurance. If you're a general practitioner who also performs obstetric services, you get 60%, and any other kind of medical specialty receives 40%. And that money is paid by us to the primary liability insurer, who either charges that the physician a net amount or charges them the full amount and then sends them a check for a refund later. Now, that money is paid out initially by SAFE, but we then take that money back from other monies that we would send to DCBS. And this, of course, is a little different for SAFE because this is not a workers' compensation program, but we were an entity that was set up in a way that we could administer this, and so we were selected to do that. Of course, our primary business is workers' compensation, and in addition to the premiums that we collect what's called the workers' compensation assessment, which is charged against every policy, and that money is then remitted to DCBS to enable them to administer and regulate the workers' compensation system. And so when we pay money out as these subsidies for malpractice insurance, we then collect that money back from the workers' compensation assessment that goes to DCBS. So there is no, we handle the money, we're out of pocket for a while until we take it back, but the net result is that there is no financial detriment to SAFE other than the cost of administering the program. As of October 31st, 2006, as you heard from Corey, the number of physicians that are involved and have participated in this program is 1,154, and that number rose pretty quickly up to 1,000 or so. Out of that total, the program has paid out $14.8 million to 68 obstetricians, 72 family physicians who also provide obstetrical services, and 1,014 other eligible physicians. So of the money that we have paid out up to this point, 25% of the total dollars has gone to the 68 obstetricians, 11% has gone to the family physicians who provide obstetrical services, and 64% of the money has gone to the other 1,000 physicians.
Point of clarification, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes. When the check is written, who does it go to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Vercher, it goes to the medical malpractice insurance company that the physician chooses to buy their insurance from.
Okay. And not to the physician himself.
That's correct.
All right.
And the next paragraph on page 4, we lay out where...
Mr. Chair,
yes.
On that issue, I mean, the intent of the bill was definitely to cover the OB and physicians and the family physicians. Out of the 64%, do you have a breakdown of what specialties or type of practice they have done, what they did? I mean, I know that in the news it was the plastic surgeon who...
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Munnis-Anderson, it's not included in this testimony. Peter, do we have that?
We do have that back at the office.
Okay, so we could provide you with that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The physicians who have benefited from this are in 31 of Oregon's 36 counties. The lowest number is one physician in Sherman County, and 140 physicians in Douglas County is the highest number in any particular county. Douglas County and Umatilla County also have the most OBGYNs, with 7 in each county, and Marion County has the most family practitioners who also offer obstetric services, and there are 12 physicians that fall into that category. From the time the program began up to the numbers at the end of October, the number of physicians that are participating has increased by around 25%. Speaking then about the amount of money that we have that we expect to spend, as Corey correctly stated, we are anticipating that by the end of this calendar year, 2007, we will be spending $21 to $22 million, all things being equal. And the total amount that was originally allocated for this program was $40 million over that four-year period. And there are a number of reasons why that number has actually come in lower than was anticipated, partly because of the lowering of premium rates that are being currently charged for malpractice insurance. We do conduct audits of the expenditures by the medical malpractice insurers.
Just a question on that. Yes. And why are premiums going down? Because there are less liability cases?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis-Anderson, couldn't really hazard a guess as to why premiums are going down. It obviously fluctuates based on loss experience, and so I assume that the primary malpractice insurers are finding that their experience is better than they had expected.
But you don't have any follow-up?
Yeah.
You don't have any statistics as...
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis-Anderson, we have statistics, obviously, about the amount of the premium, but not the actuarial basis for arriving at the premium.
Thank you.
So the future of the program is obviously up to this legislature, because without any action it will expire at the end of 2007. We're obviously aware of parties who will come in with suggested tweaks to Senate Bill 183. We also have some technical amendments that we're working with DCBS on. I believe Ms. Streisinger mentioned that the city of Grants Pass is currently moved from being a rural to a non-rural area simply by the growth of its population and crossing that threshold of 30,000. My understanding is about 100 physicians will no longer participate in that in the program out of the 1,100 that are in right now, so it's about a 8 or 9% reduction in the number of participating physicians. And during the course of the next 5 years, almost until this would expire, there could well be other cities that cross that threshold and might reduce the total number of participating physicians. As Corey also mentioned, the way the program is set up, we will pay out the 80, 60, 40% subsidies as long as we think there is enough money to last for the entire period. If we believe that the money is going to run out, then we would resubmit a plan to DCBS for approval that would cut that amount of that subsidy proportionally, just to make the money last to the end of the period.
What kind of anecdotal evidence or do you have that this has been a successful program? What if the money runs out? What do you expect to change that would be detrimental?
Mr. Chair, if I could, Corey Streisinger, yeah. For the record again, I think actually Mr. Ekblad may be in the best position to answer that based on some information that they've gathered.
Yes, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Office of Rural Health, and it wasn't actually our office, but other professionals at Oregon Health and Science University have done a bit of a survey. Both qualitative and quantitative information was gathered, and the responses, they surveyed all the physicians who have participated in this program and asked them a number of questions, including what do you think you would do if the subsidy were to end, and absolutely overwhelmingly they said they would at least, the majority said that they would at least stop doing high-risk medicine, and understand that usually involves obstetrics in general, but also there's surgical and emergency medicine specialties that would be affected as well, and others simply said they would just leave rural practice. Mm-hmm. Now, since our office didn't conduct the survey, I don't have the tabulated results, mm-hmm. but I'm happy to help share them with you.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah. Other questions? Yes, Senator George.
This is more one of those anecdotal. Just about 2 days ago, I got a phone call from one of my mayors of a small town. He was just rejoicing over the fact that they had finally been able to get a physician to come to that town. And it's an area within the industry that, in fact, where you would need to have emergency response. And it's amazing that they've made it this far. But as soon as we looked at this, I thought, I wonder if that person would make a decision to suspend that practice. Because, you know, obviously he had to think a lot before he came out there. Mm-hmm. So, thanks.
Mr. Chair, I'd just also like to point out that Exhibit 1 and Exhibit 2 that are attached to the testimony give a little more detailed breakdown about where the money is going. Exhibit 1 is by insurance carrier. Exhibit 2 is by counties.
Are there other states that have done this? Are you aware of other programs?
Mr. Chair, again, Corey Streisinger, for the record. I am not aware of other states that have done it. Shortly after we enacted our program, we got a number of calls, however, from states that were interested. And what we might do is go back and look at whether, in fact, they did implement similar programs. We definitely know there was interest.
Okay. Now, I mentioned earlier that there was one physician who moved here from Tennessee or Arkansas. Tennessee. Okay. And is now, I met the spouse of that physician at the Rural Health Conference, and that person is practicing in Pendleton, I believe. Okay. Any other anecdotal information about people who've moved here? Or I think it's really important to talk about the success story. This is an extremely important program, and I think you've shown that it is effective and that people are doing things they wouldn't otherwise do, and they're willing to stay in places they otherwise wouldn't be in, and I think that's wonderful. And what are you doing now? And you're having a group work on your brainstorming. Tell us what process you're going through before you come back to us with a finished product.
Mr. Chair, there are a number of members who've expressed interest in this, and we have been asked to get together with some members to talk about what some of the options are. And we are also then collating the data, the survey data, the data about specialization, the data about how the program has been used. So we do expect to come back to you not only with a more robust set of data, but also then with a selection of options for you.
Okay.
Senator Chair, I guess just an opinion that the investment of $40 million over 8 years to keep health care in rural Oregon is a small price to pay. And I guess just the one concern, I understand as things are currently structured what you folks would have to do if it appears that there's not enough funding. I guess I would wonder if we should consider putting language in that would allow the program to continue as you've got it structured for the next 2 years with another look at it in 2009 rather than tracking a four-year time frame with the assumption that it's going to run out of money, so we're going to start shortening it now rather than, because we will have another legislative session where we could take a deliberative look at it, and I think I'd be more comfortable with something like that.
Chair, you know, I was very enthusiastic about this program because I had in my own mind Reedsport. I was thinking of, I go from Coos Bay to Lincoln City, and I'm thinking all the way up the coast we have these little communities. Never in a million years was I thinking of a doctor 15 miles out of Portland. So I think that I have to tell you, it would have chilled my enthusiasm. Also, we have a rotation of physicians in Coos Bay, and we're rural, and they're not staying. Reedsport no longer has anyone to deliver babies. So my question to you is, while you've been effective in what you've done for those that you've been serving, what has happened in rural Oregon since then, and are you getting doctors in rural Oregon, and are they staying? Because if I'm going by my district, I'm going to tell you that I don't see that happening. So if that was part of the purpose of this program, then I think we need to step back before we declare it too successful.
Okay. Response.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, clearly the issue of attracting and retaining rural doctors is a multifaceted problem. Mm-hmm. This addresses one issue, but there are other issues. Issues like access to emergency facilities. Issues like access to a second doctor to provide coverage while someone takes a vacation or even a weekend. Access to education. Access to specialists to consult with. Other financial issues. So all of those, in the broad sense, can come into play. And this is not the only proposal or issue on the table. And so when we come back, I think what we'd like to do also is lay out some of those other concerns and some of those other programs, because it is a very challenging issue. And there are a lot of stresses, and I think all of us know, associated with practicing medicine in a rural area.
However, I think malpractice is probably at the top of their list.
It certainly shows up as a significant issue.
Yes. Senator George.
Scott, on page 2, you made mention if an email address has been included in the affidavit, notify the practitioner. And so the question is have we notified the practitioners with the indication that this whole idea might go away? Because we should be able to get some almost immediate feedback as to what the impact would be on these physicians. I see some heads nodding.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator George, we have not. We have not done that. However, again, they've all been surveyed, and so we probably know their opinions already.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Sanders.
I think that when it came to light the type where some of this money was going, some of us were appalled. And I want to know if this legislation is going to address abuse of this. And again, it's difficult because the way the law is written, no one's breaking the law. But I would feel that some of these physicians are not. The intent was not to support, plastic surgeons for, and I don't know if we could even change the law that would more focus on this conditions like Senator Verger was addressing, trying to make it easier for those who are really not being successful at all at recruiting or retaining their OB physicians and their family practice physicians.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Anderson, that's one of the challenges for how to structure the bill. And, of course, those options are all available, whether it is looking at the definition of rural. And, of course, we have already identified different gradations, if you will, of need in rural areas. So that is one approach that would be possible. Looking at different specializations and potentially excluding some specializations would be another option. So there are a number of ways to address that issue. You're absolutely correct that that everyone receiving, at least so far as we know, and we do audit and we do pay close attention to it, we believe that the physicians receiving funding under the bill are in fact entitled to receive it under the bill, mm-hmm. because the decisions that were made in 2003 were to reach broadly. And as with any program like this, it's extremely challenging to be precise enough to include all the people you want to include, not include the people you don't, and do it using objective factors that can be easily applied on a going forward basis. That's one of those really difficult challenges. So we now have the opportunity of having seen the program in place for several years and taking a fresh look at those issues, and that's part of what we want to get that input on and sit down with some of the folks who are interested and really work through.
Okay.
I don't have an answer to propose to you today, and I think we've heard a variety of views on that. I'm sure we'll continue to hear a variety of views.
Scott, your agency is involved in the administration of the program, right?
Correct.
Okay. Would it be reasonable to have a 3-member board, a vetting board, to take a look at the applicants and to, you know, not in real great detail, but just to ensure that you have the right people in the right place, and if there is going to be a financial problem, and if the money's running out, that would be one way. I mean, it just seems to me that to review the applicants, they do apply for the program, and to review the applicants, what happens now? Is there, you just take people who apply who are eligible. Is that right? The eligibility standards are fairly broad.
Yes, Senator Morissette, that's exactly what happens. They apply. They send in an affidavit that wherein they attest that they meet the eligibility criteria, and that list is then passed along to SAFE.
Okay. So
But again, if you convene a three-member panel, they would have to have objective criteria to follow, and that's therein lies the rub, because there is a domino effect. I mean, we can all acknowledge the fact that Ashland is a bit of a different community in Oregon. It's unique in many ways. On the other hand, there are other communities that are within 10 miles of Salem, for example, that you could perfectly understand. It would be very difficult, and you want to ensure that there is good quality medical care in Independence, for example, or in other communities that are unlike Ashland, and so it's hard to come up with objective criteria that fit every single circumstance.
Well, I guess I would recommend that there be some review process, that there be a board, a panel, whatever, to just take a look at the applicants, and that be... I don't know how you write that into the statute. Obviously, you have to make some changes if you do that. Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess... And I'll use Senator Mona Sanderson's example of a plastic surgeon, and you could have a plastic surgeon in Klamath Falls who does cosmetic surgery, but if they're the only one who's capable of doing reconstructive surgery,
that's different.
Well, yeah. But it's not different. It's the same. You know, I mean, for us to try and to put sideboards on which physicians gets us into a real mess, I think, and because it would be hard to find a discipline that's covered that doesn't have some real world value, and as with the plastic surgeon as the example. And so I think we need to tread very careful if we're going down to impaneling somebody to bless this physician and not that, because if we do that, we get into making subjective judgments and we open ourselves up to a whole lot of stuff we don't want to deal with.
Okay, let me try it one more time. With limited resources and a greater number of people who are applying for it, there may have to be some decisions made about where to apply the resources. It could be based on areas of need. That could be one criteria, you know, and it could be based on the type of physician. Now, I don't know if any thought is given to that now. I mean, if so many people apply and they're all qualified and they're all accepted, that could lead to some inequities in distribution. So I guess maybe what I'm thinking is, how do we better distribute the available resources among physicians that are needed in that particular area? So instead of giving all of the whoever applies and granting them that, we make sure that there is that distribution. If there isn't a review board, there should be, and you don't have to get into the necessarily the qualifications. But I agree about the reconstructive surgery. I mean, a plastic surgeon might provide a huge need to a particular community in case of a serious accident. So go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, under the existing program, that the kinds of specialties are already sliced and diced to a certain extent, because we've established an 80% reimbursement for an obstetrician, mm-hmm. a 60% level, and a 40% level for everybody else. And so if someone were to sit down and go through all of the specialties, there could be, rather than just three categories, maybe there could be 10 different categories that go from 80% down to 10%. So that, I mean, at least in concept, that's already being done under the existing plan, and that could be fine-tuned.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Berger.
Just for my own information, in the 3 years the program has been in effect, has there been any analysis by any group up until right now when you're coming about the extension, the sunset analysis, or any investigation at all into the program and how it's run and how people have been selected, or in any way?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I think the closest to that is the study that OHSU has just been completing during the latter half of last year. I know they've gone through a number of drafts. I'm not sure that it's out on the street and available yet, but they have certainly been looking at the effectiveness of the program and some of the things that you've mentioned.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
You know, we have a real critical need in the state of Oregon to provide basic, affordable health care to everyone. And I think that our intent was definitely to have a program like this because access is an issue. Even if we provided health care to everybody with a universal health care, still if we don't have the providers, it's not going to work. So anything that's going to help that situation. So, again, this is sort of a tricky, very tricky. We don't want to make any mistakes, but we definitely want to be using our dollars in a very wise way. So it's a good start.
Well, it is, and I guess my parting words are go forth and do good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Don't screw up.
And we look forward to working with
that. I think it's wonderful, and I'm really, really happy that we're hearing this at the beginning, and then you'll come back with the final product at some point, and we'll move it out and so on. I think there have been some good suggestions, and we may not have to wait 2 years for the next legislative session. We may have to wait until next February, right? Anyway, thank you very, very much for being here.
We may
thank
never you. Get out of this one.
We're not sure. Okay, we will close the public hearing.